He turned back and addressed the others, ignoring Lizzie and Jay. There's a little fire damp. Lizzie wanted to turn and run, but McCash seemed calm. It's not enough to sound the alarm. Not yet, anyway. We'll check in different places and see how far it extends. Lizzie found his equanimity incredible. What kind of people were these miners? Though their lives were brutally hard, their spirit seemed unquenchable. By comparison, her own life seemed pampered and purposeless. Jay took Lizzie's arm. I think we've seen enough, don't you? He murmured. Lizzie did not argue. Her curiosity had been satisfied long ago. Her back ached from bending constantly. She was tired and dirty and scared, and she wanted to get out on the surface and feel the wind on her face. They hurried along the tunnel toward the shaft. The mine was busy now, and there were bearers in front of them and behind. The women hitched their skirts above their knees for freedom of movement and carried their candles in their teeth. They moved slowly under their enormous burdens. Lizzie saw a man relieving himself into the drainage ditch in full view of the women and girls. Can't he find somewhere private to do that? She thought. Then she realized that down here there was nowhere private. They reached the shaft and started up the stairs. The bearers went up on all fours, like small children. It suited their bent posture. They climbed at a steady pace. There was no chattering and joking now. The women and girls panted and groaned beneath the tremendous weights they were carrying. After a while, Lizzie had to rest, but the bearers never stopped, and she felt humiliated and sick with guilt as she watched little girls pass her with their loads, some of them crying from pain and exhaustion. Now and again a child would slow down or stop for a moment, only to be hurried along by a curse or a brutal blow from its mother. Lizzie wanted to comfort them. All the emotions of the night came together and turned into anger. I swear, she said vehemently, I'll never allow coal to be mined on my land as long as I live. Before Jay could make any reply, a bell began to ring. The alarm, Jay said. They must have found more fire damp. Lizzie groaned and got to her feet. Her calves felt as if someone had stuck knives in them. Never again, she thought. I'll carry you, Jay said, and without more ado, he slung her over his shoulder and began to climb the stairs. Chapter 8. The fire damp spread with terrifying speed. At first, the blue tinge had been visible only when the candle was at roof level, but a few minutes later it appeared a foot below the roof, and Mac had to stop testing for fear of setting fire to it before the pit was evacuated. He was breathing in short, panicky gasps. He tried to be calm and think clearly. Normally, the gas seeped out gradually, but this was different. Something unusual must have happened. Most likely, fire damp had accumulated in a sealed-off area of exhausted workings. Then an old wall had cracked and was rapidly leaking the dreaded gas into the occupied tunnels. And every man, woman, and child here carried a lighted candle. A small trace would burn safely. A moderate amount would flash, scorching anyone in the vicinity. And a large quantity would explode, killing everyone and destroying the tunnels. He took a deep breath. His first priority was to get everyone out of the pit as fast as possible. He rang the handbell vigorously while he counted to 12. By the time he stopped, miners and bearers were hurrying along the tunnel towards the shaft, mothers urging their children to go faster. While everyone else fled the pit, his two bearers stayed, his sister Esther, calm and efficient, and his cousin Annie, who was strong and quick, but also impulsive and clumsy. Using their coal shovels, the two women began frantically to dig a shallow trench the length and breadth of Mac in the floor of the tunnel. Meanwhile, Mac snatched an oilcloth bundle hanging from the roof of his room and ran for the mouth of the tunnel. After his parents died, there had been some muttering among the men about whether Mac was old enough to take over his father's role of fireman. Apart from the responsibility of the job, the fireman was regarded as a leader in the community. In truth, Mac himself had shared their doubts. But no one else wanted the job. It was unpaid and dangerous. And when he dealt efficiently with the first crisis, the muttering stopped. Now he was proud that older men trusted him, but his pride also forced him to appear calm and confident, even when he was afraid. He reached the mouth of the tunnel. The last stragglers were heading up the stairs. Now Mac had to get rid of the gas. Burning was the only way to do this. He had to set fire to it. It was evilly bad luck that this should happen today. It was his birthday. He was leaving. Now he wished he had thrown caution to the winds and left the glen on Sunday night. He had told himself that a wait of a day or two might make the Jamiesons think he was going to stay and lull them into a false sense of security. He felt sick at heart that in his final hours as a coal miner he had to risk his life to save the pit he was about to quit forever. If the fire damp were not burned off, the pit would close, and a pit closure in a mining village was like a failed harvest in a farming community. People starved. Mac would never forget the last time the pit closed, 4 winters ago. During the harrowing weeks that followed, the youngest and oldest villagers had died, including both his parents. The day after his mother died, Mac had dug up a nest of hibernating rabbits and had broken their necks while they were still groggy, and that meat had saved him and Esther. He stepped out onto the deck and tore the waterproof wrappings off his bundle. Inside was a big torch made of dry sticks and rags, a ball of string, and a large version of the hemispherical candle holder the miners used, fixed to a flat wooden base so that it could not fall over. Mac stuck the torch firmly in the holder, tied the string to the base, and lit the torch with his candle. It blazed up immediately. Here it would burn safely, for the lighter-than-air gas could not gather at the bottom of the shaft. But his next task was to get the burning torch into the tunnel. He took another moment to lower himself into the drainage pool at the bottom of the shaft, soaking his clothes and hair in the icy water to give him a little extra protection from burns. Then he hurried back along the tunnel, unwinding the ball of string, at the same time scrutinizing the floor, removing large stones and other objects that might obstruct the movement of the blazing torch as it was drawn into the tunnel. When he reached Esther and Annie, he saw by the light of the one candle on the floor that all was ready. The trench was dug. Esther was dipping a blanket into the drainage ditch, and now she quickly wrapped it around Mac. Shivering, he lay down in the trench, still holding the end of the string. Annie knelt beside him, and somewhat to his surprise, kissed him full on the lips. Then she covered the trench with a heavy board, closing him in. There was a sloshing sound as they poured more water on the board, in a further attempt to protect him from the flames he was about to ignite. Then one of them tapped 3 times, the sign that they were leaving. He counted to 100 to give them time to get out of the tunnel. Then, with his heart full of dread, he started to pull on the string, drawing the blazing torch into the mine, towards where he lay, in a tunnel half full of explosive gas. Jay carried Lizzie to the top of the stairs and set her down on the icy mud at the pit head. "Are you all right?" he said.
"I'm so glad to be above ground again," she said gratefully. "I can't thank you enough for carrying me. You must be exhausted."
"You weigh a good deal less than a cough full of coal," he said with a smile. He talked as if her weight were nothing, but he looked a little unsteady on his legs as they walked away from the shaft. However, he had never faltered on the way up. Daybreak was still hours away, and it had started to snow, not in gently drifting flakes, but in driving icy pellets that blew into Lizzie's eyes. As the last of the miners and bearers came out of the shaft, Lizzie noticed the young woman whose child had been christened on Sunday. Jen, her name was. Although her child was only a week or so old, the poor woman was carrying a full cough. Surely she should have taken a rest after giving birth. She emptied the basket on the dump and handed the tallyman a wooden marker. Lizzie guessed the markers were used to calculate the wages at the end of the week. Perhaps Jen was too much in need of money to have time off. Lizzie continued to watch because Jen looked distressed. With her candle raised above her head, she darted among the crowd of 70 or 80 mine workers, peering through the falling snow, calling, "Wally! Wally!" It seemed she was searching for a child. She found her husband and had a rapid, frightened conversation with him. Then she screamed, "No!" ran to the pit head and started back down the stairs. The husband went to the edge of the shaft, then came back and looked around the crowd again, visibly distressed and bewildered. Lizzie said to him, "What's the matter?" He replied in a shaky voice, "We can't find our laddie, and she thinks he's still down the pit."
"Oh, no."
Lizzie looked over the edge. She could see some kind of torch blazing at the bottom of the shaft. But as she looked, it moved and disappeared into the tunnel. Mac had done this on 3 previous occasions, but this time it was much more frightening. Formerly, the concentration of fire damp had been much lower, a slow seep rather than a sudden build-up. His father had dealt with major gas leaks, of course, and his father's body, as he washed himself in front of the fire on Saturday nights, had been covered with the marks of old burns. Mac shivered in his blanket, sodden with icy water. As he steadily wound in the string, pulling the blazing torch closer to himself and to the gas, he tried to calm his fear by thinking about Annie. They had grown up together and had always been fond of one another. Annie had a wild soul and a muscular body. She had never kissed him in public before, but she had often done it secretly. They had explored one another's bodies and taught each other how to give pleasure. They had tried all sorts of things together, only stopping short of what Annie called making bairns. And they had almost done that. It was no use. He still felt terrified. To calm himself, he tried to think in a detached way about how the gas moved and gathered. His trench was at a low point in the tunnel, so the concentration here should be less. But there was no accurate way of estimating it until it ignited. He was afraid of pain, and he knew that burns were torment. He was not really afraid to die. He did not think about religion much, but he believed God must be merciful. However, he did not want to die now. He had done nothing, seen nothing, been nowhere. He had spent all his life so far as a slave. "If I survive this night," he vowed, "I will leave the glen today. I'll kiss Annie and say goodbye to Esther and defy the Jamisons and walk away from here, so help me God." The amount of string which had gathered in his hands told him the torch was now about halfway to him. It could light the fire damp at any moment. However, it might not catch fire at all. Sometimes his father had told him the gas seemed to vanish, no one knew where. He felt a slight resistance to his pull and knew that the torch was rubbing against the wall where the tunnel curved. If he looked out, he would be able to see it. "Surely the gas must blow now," he thought. Then he heard a voice. He was so shocked that at first he thought he was having a supernatural experience, an encounter with a ghost or a demon. Then he realized that it was neither. He was hearing the voice of a terrified small child, crying and saying, "Where is everyone?" Mac's heart stopped. He knew instantly what had happened. As a small boy working in the mine, he had often fallen asleep during his 15-hour day. This child had done the same and had slept through the alarm. Then it had woken up, found the pit deserted, and panicked. It took Mac only a split second to realize what he had to do. He pushed the board aside and sprang out of his trench. The scene was illuminated by the burning torch, and he could see the boy coming out of a side tunnel, rubbing his eyes and wailing. It was Wally, the son of Mac's cousin Jen.
"Uncle Mac,"
he said joyfully. Mac ran for the boy, unwrapping the sodden blanket from around himself as he went. There was no room for two in the shallow trench. They would have to try to reach the shaft before the gas blew. Mac wrapped the boy in the wet blanket, saying, "There's fire damp, Wally. We've got to get out." He picked him up, tucked him under one arm, and ran on. As he approached the burning torch, he willed it not to ignite the gas, and heard himself shouting, "Not yet! Not yet!" Then they were past it. The boy was light, but it was hard to run stooping, and the floor underfoot made it more difficult. Muddy in places, thick with dust in others, and uneven everywhere, with outcroppings of rock to trip the hasty. Mac charged ahead regardless, stumbling sometimes, but managing to keep his feet, listening for the bang that might be the last sound he ever heard. As he rounded the curve in the tunnel, the light from the torch dimmed to nothing. He ran on into the darkness, but within seconds he crashed into the wall and fell headlong, dropping Wally. He cursed and scrambled to his feet. The boy began to cry. Mac located him by sound and picked him up again. He was forced to go on more slowly, feeling the tunnel wall with his free hand, cursing the dark. Then, mercifully, a candle flame appeared ahead, at the entrance to the tunnel, and Mac heard Jen's voice calling, "Wally! Wally!"
"I've got him here, Jen!" Mac shouted, breaking into a run. "Get yourself up the stair!"
She ignored his instruction and came towards him. He was only a few yards from the end of the tunnel in safety.
"Go back!"
he yelled, but she kept coming. He crashed into her and swept her up in his free arm. Then the gas blew. For a split second there was an ear-piercing hiss. Then there was a huge, deafening thump that shook the earth. A force that felt like a massive fist struck Mac's back, and he was lifted off his feet, losing his grip on Wally and Jen. He flew through the air. He felt a wave of scorching heat, and he was sure he was going to die. Then he splashed headfirst into icy water and realized he had been thrown into the drainage pool at the bottom of the mineshaft. And he was still alive. He broke the surface and dashed water from his eyes. The wooden decking and staircase were burning in places, and the flames illuminated the scene fitfully. Mac located Jen, splashing about and choking. He grabbed her and heaved her out of the water. Choking, she screamed, "Where's Wally?" He might have been knocked unconscious, Mac thought. He pushed himself from one side of the small pool to the other, bumping into the bucket chain which had ceased to operate. At last he found a floating object that turned out to be Wally. He shoved the boy onto the deck beside his mother and clambered out himself. Wally sat up and spewed water.
"Thank God," Jen sobbed. "He's alive."
Mac looked into the tunnel. Stray wisps of gas burned sporadically like fiery spirits.
"Away up the stairs with us," he said. "There might be a secondary blast."
He pulled Jen and Wally to their feet and pushed them up ahead of him. Jen lifted Wally and slung him over her shoulder. His weight was nothing to a woman who could carry a full cough of coal up these stairs 20 times in a 15-hour shift. Mac hesitated, looking at the small fires burning at the foot of the stairs. If the entire staircase burned, the pit might be out of commission for weeks while it was rebuilt. He took a few extra seconds to splash water from the pool over the flames and put them out. Then he followed Jen up. When he reached the top, he felt exhausted, bruised and dizzy. He was immediately surrounded by a crowd who shook his hand, slapped his back, and congratulated him. The crowd parted for Jay Jamison and his companion, whom Mac had recognized to be Lizzie Hallam, dressed as a man. "Well done, Macash," said Jay. "My family appreciates your courage." "You smug bastard," Mac thought. Lizzie said, "Is there really no other way to deal with fire damp?"
"No," said Jay. "Of course there is," Mac gasped.
"Really?" Lizzie said. "What?"
Mac caught his breath.
"You sink ventilation shafts, which let the gas escape before ever it can accumulate."
He took another deep breath.
"The Jamisons have been told time and time again."
There was a murmur of agreement from the miners standing around. Lizzie turned to Jay.
"Then why don't you do it?"
"You don't understand business. Why should you?" Jay said. "No man of business can pay for an expensive procedure when a cheaper one will achieve the same result. His rivals would undercut his price. It's political economy."
"Give it a fancy name if you like," Mac panted. "Ordinary folk call it wicked greed."
One or two of the miners shouted,
"Aye, that's right."
"Now, Macash," Jay remonstrated, "don't spoil everything by getting above your station again. You'll get into real trouble."
"I'm in no trouble," Mac said. "Today is my 22nd birthday."
He had not meant to say this, but now he could not stop himself.
"I haven't worked here the full year and a day, not quite, and I'm not going to."
The crowd was suddenly quiet, and Mac was filled with an exhilarating sense of freedom.
"I'm leaving, Mr. Jamison," he said. "I quit. Goodbye."
He turned his back on Jay, and in total silence, he walked away. Chapter 9. By the time Jay and Lizzie got back to the castle, 8 or 10 servants were about, lighting fires and sweeping floors by candlelight. Lizzie, black with coal dust and almost helpless with fatigue, thanked Jay in a whisper and staggered upstairs. Jay ordered a tub and hot water to be brought to his room, then took a bath, scrubbing the coal dust off his skin with a pumice stone. In the last 48 hours, momentous events had happened in his life. His father had given him a derisory patrimony, his mother had cursed his father, and he had tried to murder his brother. But none of these things occupied his mind. As he lay there, he thought about Lizzie. Her impish face appeared before him in the steam from his bath, smiling mischievously, the eyes crinkling in the corners, mocking him, tempting him, daring him. He recalled how she had felt in his arms as he had carried her up the mineshaft. She was soft and light, and he had pressed her small frame to himself as he climbed the stairs. He wondered if she was thinking about him. She must have called for hot water, too. She could hardly go to bed as dirty as she was. He pictured her standing naked in front of her bedroom fire, soaping her body. He wished he could be with her and take the sponge from her hand and gently wipe the coal dust from the slopes of her breasts. The thought aroused him, and he sprang out of the bath and rubbed himself dry with a rough towel. He did not feel sleepy. He wanted to talk to someone about the night's adventure, but Lizzie would probably sleep for hours. He thought about his mother. He could trust her. She sometimes pushed him into doing things against his inclination, but she was always on his side. He shaved and put on fresh clothes, then he went along to her room. As he expected, she was up, sipping chocolate at her dressing table, while her maid did her hair. She smiled at him. He kissed her and dropped into a chair. She was pretty, even first thing in the morning, but there was steel in her soul. She dismissed her maid.
"Why are you up so early?" she asked Jay.
"I haven't been to bed. I went down the pit."
"With Lizzie Hallam?"
She was so clever, he thought fondly. She always knew what he was up to. But he did not mind, for she never condemned him. "How did you guess?" "It wasn't difficult. She was itching to go, and she's the kind of girl who won't take no for an answer." "We chose a bad day to go down. There was an explosion."
"Dear God, are you all right?"
"Yes.
I'll send for Dr. Stevenson anyway."
"Mother, stop worrying. I was out of the pit by the time it blew. So was Lizzie. I'm just a bit weak in the knees from carrying her all the way up the shaft." Mother calmed down.
"What did Lizzie think of it?"
"She swore she would never allow mining on the Hallam estate."
Alicia laughed. "And your father is greedy for her coal. Well, I look forward to witnessing the battle. When Robert is her husband, he will have the power to go against her wishes. In theory, we shall see. But how do you think the courtship is progressing?"
"Flirting isn't Robert's strong point, to say the least," Jay said scornfully.
"It's yours, though, isn't it?" she said indulgently.
Jay shrugged. "He's doing his clumsy best."
"Perhaps she won't marry him after all."
"I think she will have to." Mother looked shrewdly at him.
"Do you know something I don't?"
"Lady Hallam is having trouble renewing her mortgages. Father has made sure of it."
"Has he? How sly he is."
Jay sighed. "She's a wonderful girl. She'll be wasted on Robert." Mother put a hand on his knee.
"Jay, my sweet boy, she's not Robert's yet."
"I suppose she might marry someone else."
"She might marry you."
"Good God, Mother." Although he had kissed Lizzie, he had not got as far as thinking of marriage.
"You're in love with her, I can tell."
"Love? Is that what this is?"
"Of course.
Your eyes light up at the mention of her name, and when she's in the room, you can't see anyone else." She had described Jay's feelings exactly. He had no secrets from his mother. "But marry her?
If you're in love with her, ask her. You'd be the Laird of Hyde Glen."
"That would be one in the eye for Robert," Jay said with a grin. His heart was racing at the thought of having Lizzie as his wife, but he tried to concentrate on the practicalities. "I'd be penniless."
"You're penniless now, but you'd manage the estate better than Lady Hallam. She's no businesswoman. It's a big place. High Glen must be 10 miles long, and she owns Craigie and Crook Glen, too. You'd clear land for grazing, sell more venison, build a water mill. You could make it produce a decent income, even without mining for coal."
"What about the mortgages?"
"You're a much more attractive borrower than she is. You're young and vigorous, and you come from a wealthy family. You would find it easy enough to renew the loans. And then, in time..."
"What?"
"Well, Lizzie is an impulsive girl. Today she vows she will never allow mining on the Hallam estate. Tomorrow, God knows, she may decide that deer have feelings and ban hunting. Next week she may have forgotten both edicts. If ever you do allow coal mining, you'll be able to pay off all your debts."
Jay grimaced. "I don't relish the prospect of going against Lizzie's wishes on something like that." He was also thinking that he wanted to be a Barbadian sugar grower, not a Scottish coal owner.
But he wanted Lizzie, too.
With disconcerting suddenness, Mother changed the subject. "What happened yesterday when you were hunting?" Jay was taken by surprise, and he found himself unable to tell a smooth lie. He flushed and stammered, and finally said, "I had another set-to with Father."
"I know that much," she said. "I could tell by your faces when you returned, but it wasn't just an argument. You did something that shook him."
"What was it?" Jay had never been able to deceive her. "I tried to shoot Robert," he confessed miserably.
"Oh, Jay, that's dreadful," she said.
He bowed his head. It was all the worse that he had failed. If he had killed his brother, the guilt would have been appalling, but there would have been a certain savage sense of triumph. This way he had the guilt on its own. Mother stood beside his chair and pulled his head to her bosom.
"My poor boy," she said. "There was no need for that. We'll find another way, don't worry."
And she rocked back and forth, stroking his hair and saying,
"There, there."
"How could you do such a thing?"
Lady Hallam wailed as she scrubbed Lizzie's back.
"I had to see for myself," Lizzie replied. "Not so hard. I have to do it hard. The coal dust won't shift." "Mac McCash riled me when he said I didn't know what I was talking about," Lizzie went on.
"And why should you?" said her mother. "What business has a young lady to know about coal mining, may I ask? I hate it when people dismiss me by saying that women don't understand about politics or farming or mining or trade. It lets them get away with all kinds of nonsense."
Lady Hallam groaned.
"I hope Robert doesn't mind your being so masculine.
He'll have to take me as I am, or not at all."
Her mother gave an exasperated sigh.
"My dear, this won't do. You must give him more encouragement. Of course a girl doesn't want to appear eager, but you go too far the other way. Now promise me you'll be nice to Robert today."
"Mother, what do you think of Jay?"
Mother smiled.
"A charming boy, of course."
She stopped suddenly and stared hard at Lizzie.
"Why do you ask?" "He kissed me in the coal mine."
"No."
Lady Hallam stood upright and hurled the pumice stone across the room.
"No, Elizabeth, I will not have this."
Lizzie was taken aback by her mother's sudden fury.
"I have not lived 20 years in penury to see you grow up and marry a handsome pauper."
"He's not a pauper."
"Yes, he is. You saw that awful scene with his father. His patrimony is a horse. Lizzie, you cannot do this."
Mother was possessed by rage. Lizzie had never seen her like this, and she could not understand it.
"Mother, calm down, won't you?" she pleaded.
She stood up and got out of the tub.
"Pass me a towel, please."
To her astonishment, her mother put her hands to her face and began to cry. Lizzie put her arms around her and said,
"Mother, dear, what is it?"
"Cover yourself, you wicked child,"
she said between sobs. Lizzie wrapped a blanket around her wet body.
"Sit down, mother."
She guided her to a chair. After a while, mother spoke.
"Your father was just like Jay, just like him,"
she said, and there was a bitter twist to the set of her mouth.
"Tall, handsome, charming, and very keen on kissing in dark places. And weak, so weak. I gave in to my lower nature and married him against my better judgment, even though I knew he was a will-o'-the-wisp. Within 3 years he had wasted my fortune, and a year after that he fell off his horse when drunk and broke his beautiful head and died."
"Oh, Mama."
Lizzie was shocked by the hatred in her mother's voice. She normally spoke of father in neutral tones. She had always told Lizzie that he was unlucky in business, that he had died tragically young, and that lawyers had made a mess of the estate's finances. Lizzie herself could hardly remember him, for she had been 3 years old when he died.
"And he scorned me for not giving him a son," Mother went on. "A son who would have been like him, faithless and feckless, and would have broken some girl's heart. But I knew how to prevent that."
Lizzie was shocked again.
Was it true that women could prevent pregnancy? Could it be that her own mother had done such a thing in defiance of her husband's wishes?
Mother seized her hand.
"Promise me you won't marry him, Lizzie. Promise me."
Lizzie pulled her hand away. She felt disloyal, but she had to tell the truth.
"I can't," she said. "I love him."
When Jay left his mother's room, his feelings of guilt and shame seemed to dissipate, and suddenly he was hungry. He went down to the dining room. His father and Robert were there, eating thick slices of grilled ham with stewed apples and sugar, talking to Harry Ratchet. Ratchet, as manager of the pits, had come to report the fire damp blast. Father looked sternly at Jay and said, "I hear you went down Huch Pit last night." Jay's appetite began to fade. "I did," he said. "There was an explosion." He poured a glass of ale from a jug. "I know all about the explosion," Father said. "Who was your companion?" Jay swallowed some beer. "Lizzie Hallam," he confessed. Robert coloured. "Damn you," he said. "You know Father did not wish her to be taken down the pit." Jay was stung into a defiant response. "Well, Father, how will you punish me? Cut me off without a penny? You've already done that." Father wagged a threatening finger. "I warn you not to disregard my orders." "You should be worrying about my cash, not me," Jay said, trying to turn his father's wrath onto another object. "He told everyone he was leaving today." Robert said, "Insubordinate damn tyke!" It was not clear whether he was referring to McCash or Jay. Harry Ratchet coughed. "You might just let McCash go, Sir George," he said. "The man's a good worker, but he's a troublemaker, and we'd be well rid of him." "I can't do that," Father replied. "McCash has taken a public stand against me. If he gets away with it, every young miner will think he can leave too." Robert put in, "It's not just us, either. This lawyer, Gordonson, could write to every pit in Scotland. If young miners are allowed to leave at the age of 21, the entire industry could collapse." "Exactly," Father agreed. "And then what would the British nation do for coal? I tell you, if I ever get Caspar Gordonson in front of me on a treason charge, I'll hang him quicker than you can say unconstitutional, so help me!" Robert said, "In fact, it's our patriotic duty to do something about McCash." They had forgotten about Jay's offence, to his relief. Keeping the conversation focused on McCash, he asked, "But what can be done?" "I could jail him," said Sir George. "No," Robert said. "When he came out, he would still claim to be a free man." There was a thoughtful silence. "He could be flogged," Robert suggested. "That might be the answer," said Sir George. "I have the right to whip them in law." Ratchet looked uneasy. "It's many years since that right was exercised by a coal owner, Sir George. And who would wield the lash?" Robert said impatiently. "Well, what do we do with troublemakers?" Sir George smiled. "We make them go the round," he said. End of side five. Side 6. Chapter 10. Mac would have liked to start walking to Edinburgh right away, but he knew that would be foolish. Even though he had not worked a full shift, he was exhausted, and the explosion had left him feeling slightly dazed. He needed time to think about what the Jamiesons might do and how he could outwit them. He went home, took off his wet clothes, lit the fire, and got into bed. His immersion in the drainage pool had made him dirtier than usual, for the water was thick with coal dust, but the blankets on his bed were so black that a little more made no difference. Like most of the men, he bathed once a week, on Saturday night. The other miners had gone back to work after the explosion. Esther had stayed at the pit with Annie to fetch the coal Mac had hewed and bring it up to the surface. She would not let hard work go to waste. As he drifted off to sleep, he wondered why men got weary more quickly than women. The hewers, all men, worked 10 hours, from midnight until 10 o'clock in the morning. The bearers, mostly women, worked from 2 a.m. until 5 p.m., 15 hours. The women's work was harder, climbing those stairs again and again with huge baskets of coal on their bent backs, yet they kept going long after their men had stumbled home and fallen into bed. Women sometimes became hewers, but it was rare. When wielding the pick or hammer, most women could not hit hard enough, and it took them too long to win the coal from the face. The men always took a nap when they came home. They would get up after an hour or so. Most would prepare dinner for their wives and children. Some spent the afternoon drinking at Mrs. Wheel's. Their wives were much pitied, for it was hard for a woman to come home, after 15 hours of bearing coal, to find no fire, no food, and a drunk husband. Life was hard for miners, but it was harder for their wives. When Mac woke up, he knew it was a momentous day, but he could not remember why. Then it came back to him. He was leaving the glen. He would not get far if he looked like an escaped coal miner, so the first thing he had to do was get clean. He built up the fire, then made several trips to the stream with the water barrel. He heated the water on the fire and brought in the tin tub that hung outside the back door. The little room became steamy. He filled the bath, then got in with a piece of soap and a stiff brush and scrubbed himself. He began to feel good. This was the last time he would ever wash coal dust off his skin. He would never have to go down a mine again. Slavery was behind him. In front of him he had Edinburgh, London, the world. He would meet people who had never heard of Hugh Pitt. His destiny was a blank sheet of paper on which he could write anything he liked. While he was in the bath, Annie came in. She hesitated just inside the door, looking troubled and uncertain. Mac smiled, offered her the brush, and said, "Would you do my back?" She came forward and took it from him, but stood looking at him with the same unhappy expression.
"Go on,"
he said. She began to scrub his back.
"They say a miner shouldn't wash his back," she said. "It's supposed to be weakening."
"I'm not a miner anymore."
She stopped. "Don't go, Mac," she pleaded. "Don't leave me here."
He had been afraid of something like this. That kiss on the lips had been a forewarning. He felt guilty. He was fond of his cousin, and he had enjoyed the fun and games they had had together last summer, rolling in the heather on warm Sunday afternoons. But he did not want to spend his life with her, especially if it meant staying in Hugh. Could he explain that without crucifying her? There were tears in her eyes, and he saw how she longed for him to promise he would stay. But he was determined to leave. He wanted it more than he had ever wanted anything.
"I must go away," he said. "I'll miss you, Annie, but I have to go." "You think you're better than the rest of us, don't you?" she said resentfully. "Your mother had ideas above her station, and you're the same. You're too good for me, is that it? You're going to London to marry a fine lady, I suppose."
His mother had certainly had ideas above her station, but he was not going to London to marry a fine lady. Was he better than the rest of them? Did he think he was too good for Annie? There was a grain of truth in what she said, and he felt embarrassed.
"We're all too good for slavery," he said.
She knelt beside the tub and put her hand on his knee above the water.
"Don't you love me, Mac?"
To his shame, he began to feel aroused. He longed to embrace her and make her feel all right again, but he hardened his heart.
"You're dear to me, Annie, but I never said I love you, no more than you did."
She slipped her hand under the water and between his legs. She smiled when she felt how stiff he was. He said,
"Where's Esther?" "Playing with Jen's new baby. She'll be away for a while."
Annie had asked her to stay away, Mac inferred. Otherwise Esther would have hurried home to talk to him about his plans.
"Stay here and let's get married,"
Annie said, caressing him. The sensation was exquisite. He had taught her how to do it last summer, and then he had made her show him how she pleasured herself. As he remembered that, he became more inflamed.
"We could do anything we liked, all the time," she said. "If I get married, I'm stuck here for life,"
Mac said, but he felt his resistance weakening. Annie stood up and pulled off her dress. She wore nothing else. Underwear was reserved for Sundays. Her body was lean and hard, with small flat breasts and a mass of dense black hair at the groin. Her skin all over was grey with coal dust, like Mac's. To his astonishment, she climbed into the tub with him, kneeling astride his legs.
"It's your turn to wash me," she said, giving him the soap.
He rubbed the soap slowly, working up a lather. Then he put his hands on her breasts. Her nipples were small and stiff. She moaned deep in her throat. Then she grasped his wrists and pushed his hands down across her hard, flat belly to her groin. His soapy fingers slipped between her thighs, and he felt the coarse curls of her thick pubic hair and the firm, soft flesh beneath it.
"Say you'll stay," she pleaded. "Let's do it. I want to feel you inside me."
He knew that if he gave in, his fate was sealed. There was something dreamily unreal about the scene.
"No,"
he said, but his voice was a whisper. She came closer, pulling his face to her breasts, then lowered herself until she was poised over him, her sexual lips just touching the swollen end of his cock where it stuck up out of the water.
"Say yes," she said.
He groaned and gave up the struggle.
"Yes," he said. "Please, quickly."
There was a terrific crash and the door flew open. Annie screamed. Four men burst in, filling the little room. Robert Jamieson, Harry Ratchet, and two of the Jamieson's keepers. Robert wore a sword and a pair of pistols, and one of the keepers carried a musket. Annie got off Mac and stepped out of the bath. Dazed and frightened, Mac stood up shakily. The keeper with the musket looked at Annie.
"Cozy cousins," he said with a leer.
Mac knew the man. His name was McAllister. He recognized the other one, a big bully called Tanner. Robert laughed harshly. "Is that what she is? His cousin? I suppose incest is nothing to coal miners." Mac's fear and bewilderment gave way to fury at this invasion of his home. He suppressed his anger and struggled to remain controlled. He was in grave danger, and there was a chance Annie would suffer too. He had to keep his wits about him, not give in to outrage. He looked at Robert.
"I'm a free man, and I've broken no laws," he said. "What are you doing in my house?"
McAllister was still staring at Annie's body, damp and steaming.
"What a pretty sight," he said thickly.
Mac turned to him. In a low, even voice he said,
"If you touch her, I'll tear the head off your neck with my hands."
McAllister looked at Mac's bare shoulders and realized he could do what he threatened. He paled and took a step back, even though he held a gun. But Tanner was bigger and more reckless, and he reached out and grasped Annie's wet breast. Mac acted without forethought. A second later, he was out of the tub and grasping Tanner by the wrist. Before anyone else could move, he had thrust Tanner's hand into the fire. Tanner screamed and writhed, but he could not escape from Mac's grip.
"Let me go!" he screeched. "Please, please!"
Mac held the man's hand in the burning coals and yelled, "Run, Annie!" Annie snatched up her dress and flew out of the back door. The butt of a musket cracked into the back of Mac's head. The blow enraged him, and with Annie gone, he became heedless. He released Tanner, then grabbed McAllister by the coat and butted him in the face, smashing the man's nose. Blood spurted, and McAllister roared with pain. Mac swung around and kicked Harry Ratchet in the groin with a bare foot as hard as a stone. Ratchet doubled up, groaning. Every fight Mac had ever fought had taken place down the pit, so he was accustomed to combat in a confined space. But four opponents were too many. McAllister hit him again with the butt of the musket, and for a moment Mac swayed, stunned. Then Ratchet grabbed him from behind, pinning his arms, and before he could release himself, the point of Robert Jamieson's sword was at his throat. After a moment, Robert said, "Tie him up." They threw him across the back of a horse and covered his nakedness with a blanket. Then they took him to Castle Jamieson and put him in the larder, still naked and tied hand and foot. He lay on the stone floor, shivering, surrounded by the dripping carcasses of deer, cattle, and pigs. He tried to warm himself by moving as much as he could, but with his hands and feet tied, he could not generate much heat. Eventually, he managed to sit up with his back against the furry hide of a dead stag. For a while, he sang to keep up his spirits. First, the ballads they crooned at Mrs. Wheel's on Saturday nights, then a few hymns, then some old Jacobite rebel ditties. But when he ran out of songs, he felt worse than before. His head hurt from the musket blows, but what pained him most was how easily the Jamiesons had taken him. What a fool he was to have delayed his departure. He had given them time to take action. While they were planning his downfall, he had been feeling his cousin's breasts. It did not help to speculate about what they had in store for him. If he did not freeze to death here in the larder, they would probably send him to Edinburgh and have him tried for assaulting the gamekeepers. Like most crimes, that was a hanging matter. The light coming through the cracks around the door gradually faded as night fell. They came for him just as the stable-yard clock struck 11. There were 6 men this time, and he did not attempt to fight them. Davy Taggart, the blacksmith who made the miner's tools, fitted an iron collar like Jimmy Lee's around Mac's neck. It was the ultimate humiliation, a sign for all the world to see, saying he was another man's property. He was less than a man, subhuman. He was livestock. They untied his bonds and threw some clothes at him, a pair of breeches, a threadbare flannel shirt, and a ripped waistcoat. He put them on hastily and still felt cold. The keepers tied his hands again and put him on a pony. They rode to the pit. The Wednesday shift would begin in a few minutes' time at midnight. The ostler was putting a fresh horse in harness to drive the bucket chain. Mac realized they were going to make him go the round. He groaned aloud. It was a crushing, humiliating torture. He would have given his life for a bowl of hot porridge in a few minutes in front of a blazing fire. Instead, he was doomed to spend the night in the open air. He wanted to fall on his knees and beg for mercy, but the thought of how that would please the Jamisons stiffened his pride, and instead he roared, "You've no right to do this! No right!" The keepers laughed at him. They stood him in the muddy, circular track around which the pithead horses trotted day and night. He squared his shoulders and held his head high, although he felt like bursting into tears. They tied him to the harness, facing the horse, so that he could not get out of its way. Then the ostler whipped the horse into a trot. Mac began to run backwards. He stumbled almost immediately, and the horse drew up. The ostler whipped it again, and Mac scrambled to his feet just in time. He began to get the knack of running backwards. Then he became overconfident and slipped on the icy mud. This time the horse charged on. Mac slid to one side, writhing and twisting to get away from the hooves, and was dragged alongside the horse for a second or two. Then he lost control and slipped under the horse's feet. The horse trod on his stomach and kicked his thigh, then stopped. They made Mac stand up, then they lashed the horse again. The blow to the stomach had winded Mac, and his left leg felt weak, but he was forced into a limping backwards run. He gritted his teeth and tried to settle into a rhythm. He had seen others suffer this punishment, Jimmy Lee for one. They had survived, although they bore the marks. Jimmy Lee had a scar over his left eye where the horse had kicked him, and the resentment that burned inside Jimmy was fueled by the memory of the humiliation. Mac, too, would survive. His mind dulled with pain and cold and defeat, he thought of nothing but staying on his feet and avoiding those deadly hooves. As time went by, he began to feel an affinity with the horse. They were both in harness and compelled to run in a circle. When the ostler cracked his whip, Mac went a little faster, and when Mac stumbled, the horse seemed to slacken its pace for a moment to allow him to recover. He was aware of the hewers arriving at midnight to begin their shift. They came up the hill, talking and shouting, ribbing one another and telling jokes as usual. Then they fell silent as they approached the pit head and saw Mac. The keepers hefted their muskets menacingly whenever a miner seemed disposed to stop. Mac heard Jimmy Lee's voice raised in indignation and saw from the corner of his eye 3 or 4 other miners surround Jimmy, taking him by the arms and pushing and shoving him towards the pit to keep him out of trouble. Gradually Mac lost all sense of time. The bearers arrived, women and children chattering on their way up the hill, then falling silent, as the men had, when they passed Mac. He heard Annie cry, "Oh, dear God, they've made Mac go the round!" She was kept away from him by the Jamison's men, but she called out, "Esther's looking for you. I'll fetch her." Esther appeared some time later, and before the keepers could prevent her, she stopped the horse. She held a flagon of hot, sweetened milk to Mac's lips. It tasted like the elixir of life, and he gulped it frantically, almost choking himself. He managed to drain the jug before they pulled Esther away. The night wore on as slow as a year. The keepers put down their muskets and sat around the ostler's fire. Coal mining went on. The bearers came up from the pit, emptied their corves on the dump, and went down again in their endless round. When the ostler changed the horse, Mac got a few minutes' rest, but the fresh horse trotted faster. There came a moment when he realized it was daylight again. Now it could be only an hour or two until the hewers stopped work.
but an hour was forever. A pony came up the hill. Out of the corner of his eye, Mac saw the rider get off and stand staring at him. Looking briefly in that direction, he recognized Lizzie Hallam in the same black fur coat she had worn to church. Was she here to mock him? He wondered. He felt humiliated and wished she would go away. But when he looked again at her elfin face, he saw no mockery there. Instead, there was compassion, anger, and something else he could not read. Another horse came up the hill, and Robert got off. He spoke to Lizzie in an irate undertone. Lizzie's reply was clearly audible.
"This is barbaric!"
In his distress, Mac felt profoundly grateful to her. Her indignation comforted him. It was some small consolation to know that there was one person among the gentry who felt human beings should not be treated this way. Robert replied indignantly, but Mac could not make out his words. While they were arguing, the men began to come up from the pit. However, they did not return to their homes. Instead, they stood around the horse gin, watching without speaking. The women also began to gather. When they had emptied their corves, they did not go back down the shaft, but joined the silent crowd. Robert ordered the ostler to stop the horse. Mac at last stopped running. He tried to stand proud, but his legs would not support him, and he fell to his knees. The ostler came to untie him, but Robert stopped the man with a gesture. Robert spoke loud enough for everyone to hear.
"Well, Macash, you said yesterday that you were one day short of servitude. Now you have worked that extra day. Even by your own foolish rules, you are my father's property now."
He turned around to address the crowd. But before he could speak again, Jimmy Lee started to sing. Jimmy had a pure tenor voice, and the notes of a familiar hymn soared out across the glen. "Behold a man in anguish bending, marked by pain and loss, yonder stony hill ascending, carrying a cross." Robert flushed red and shouted, "Be quiet!" Jimmy ignored him and began the second verse. The others joined in, some singing the harmonies, and 100 voices swelled the melody. "He is now transfixed with sorrow in the eyes of men. When we see the bright tomorrow, he will rise again." Robert turned away, helpless. He stamped across the mud to his horse, leaving Lizzie standing alone, a small figure of defiance. He mounted and rode off down the hill, looking furious, with the thrilling voices of the miners shaking the mountain air like a thunderstorm. "Look no more with eyes of pity, see our victory. When we build that heavenly city, all men shall be free." Chapter 11. Jay woke up knowing he was going to propose marriage to Lizzie. It was only yesterday that his mother had put it into his mind, but the idea had taken root fast. It seemed natural, even inevitable. Now he was worried about whether she would have him. She liked him well enough, he thought. Most girls did. But she needed money, and he had none. Mother said those problems could be solved, but Lizzie might prefer the certainty of Robert's prospects. The idea of her marrying Robert was loathsome. To his disappointment, he found she had gone out early. He was tense, too tense to wait around the house for her to return. He went out to the stables and looked at the white stallion his father had given him for his birthday. The horse's name was Blizzard. Jay had vowed never to ride him, but he could not resist the temptation. He took Blizzard up to High Glen and galloped him along the springy turf beside the stream. It was worth breaking his vow. He felt as if he were on the back of an eagle, soaring through the air, borne up by the wind. Blizzard was at his best when galloping. Walking or trotting, he was skittish, unsure of his footing, discontented and bad-tempered. But it was easy to forgive a horse for being a poor trotter when he could run like a bullet. As Jay rode home, he indulged himself in thoughts of Lizzie. She had always been exceptional, even as a girl, pretty and rebellious and beguiling. Now she was unique. She could shoot better than anyone Jay knew. She had beaten him in a horse race. She was not afraid to go down a coal mine. She could disguise herself and fool everyone at a dinner table. He had never met a woman like her. She was difficult to deal with, of course. Willful, opinionated, and self-centred. She was more ready than most women to challenge what men said. But Jay and everyone else forgave her because she was so charming, tilting her pert little face this way and that, smiling and frowning, even as she contradicted every word you said. He reached the stable yard at the same time as his brother. Robert was in a bad mood. When angry, he became even more like father, red-faced and pompous. Jay said, "What the devil is the matter with you?" But Robert threw his reins to a groom and stomped indoors. While Jay was stabling Blizzard, Lizzie rode up. She too was upset, but the flush of anger on her cheeks and the glint in her eyes made her even prettier. Jay stared at her, enraptured. "I want this girl," he thought. "I want her for myself." He was ready to propose right then and there, but before he could speak, she jumped off her horse and said, "I know that people who misbehave must be punished, but I don't believe in torture, do you?" He saw nothing wrong in torturing criminals, but he was not going to tell her that, not when she was in this mood. "Of course I don't," he said. "Have you come from the pithead?" "It was awful. I told Robert to let the man go, but he refused." So she had quarrelled with Robert. Jay concealed his delight. "You haven't seen a man go the round before? It's not so rare." "No, I haven't. I don't know how I've remained so wretchedly ignorant about the lives of miners. I suppose people protected me from the grim truth because I was a girl."
"Robert seemed angry about something," Jay probed. "All the miners sang a hymn and they wouldn't shut up when he ordered them to."
Jay was pleased. It sounded as if she had seen Robert at his worst. "My chances of success are improving by the minute," he thought exultantly. A groom took her horse and they walked across the yard into the castle. Robert was talking to Sir George in the hall. "It was a piece of brazen defiance," Robert was saying. "Whatever happens, we must make sure Macash doesn't get away with this." Lizzie made an exasperated noise, and Jay saw a chance to score points with her.
"I think we should consider letting Macash go," he said to his father.
Robert said, "Don't be ridiculous." Jay recalled Harry Ratchett's argument. "The man is a troublemaker. We'd be better off without him."
"He has defied us openly," Robert protested. "He can't be allowed to get away with it." "He hasn't got away with it," Lizzie declared. "He suffered the most savage punishment."
Sir George said, "It's not savage, Elizabeth. You have to understand that they don't feel pain as we do." Before she could expostulate, he turned to Robert. "But it's true that he hasn't got away with it. The miners now know they can't leave at the age of 21. We've proved our point. I wonder if we shouldn't discreetly let him vanish."
Robert was not satisfied. "Jimmy Lee is a troublemaker, but we brought him back."
"Different case," father argued. "Lee is all heart and no brains. He'll never be a leader. We have nothing to fear from him. Macash is made of finer material."
"I'm not afraid of Macash," Robert said.
"He could be dangerous," father said. "He can read and write. He's the fireman, which means they look up to him. And to judge by the scene you've just described to me, he's halfway to becoming a hero already. If we make him stay here, he'll cause trouble all his godforsaken life."
Reluctantly, Robert nodded.
"I still think it looks bad," he said. "Then make it look better," father said. "Leave the guard on the bridge. Macash will go over the mountain, probably. We just won't chase him. I don't mind them thinking he's escaped, so long as they know he did not have the right to leave."
"Very well," said Robert. Lizzie shot a triumphant look at Jay. Behind Robert's back, she mouthed the words, "Well done."
"I must wash my hands before dinner," Robert said. He disappeared towards the back of the house, still looking grumpy. Father went into his study.
Lizzie threw her arms around Jay's neck.
"You did it," she said. "You set him free."
She gave him an exuberant kiss. It was scandalously bold, and he was shocked, but he soon recovered. He put his arms around her waist and held her close. He leaned down, and they kissed again. This was a different kiss, slow and sensual and exploring. Jay closed his eyes to concentrate on the sensations. He forgot they were in the most public room of his father's castle, where family and guests, neighbours and servants, passed through constantly. By luck, no one came in, and the kiss was not disturbed. When they broke apart,
gasping for breath. They were still alone. With a thrill of anxiety, Jay realized that this was the moment to ask her to marry him.
Lizzie!
Somehow he did not know just how to bring the subject up.
What? What I want to say... You can't marry Robert, no. I can do anything I like,
she responded immediately.
Of course, that was the wrong tack to take with Lizzie. Never tell her what she can and can't do. I didn't mean...
Robert might turn out to be even better at kissing than you, she said, and she grinned impishly. Jay laughed. Lizzie leaned her head on his chest.
Of course I can't marry him. Not now.
Because... She looked at him.
Because I'm going to marry you. Am I not?
He could hardly believe she had said that.
Well, yes. Isn't that what you were about to ask me? As a matter of fact, yes, it is. There you are, then. Now you can kiss me again.
Feeling a little dazed, he bent his head to hers. As soon as their lips met, she opened her mouth, and he was shocked and delighted to feel the tip of her tongue hesitantly teasing its way through. It made him wonder how many other boys she had kissed, but this was not the time to ask. He responded the same way. He felt himself stiffen inside his breeches, and he was embarrassed in case she would notice. She leaned against him, and he was sure she must have felt it. She froze for a moment, as if unsure what to do. Then she shocked him again by pressing up against him, as if eager to feel it. He had met knowing girls in the taverns and coffee-houses of London who would kiss and rub up against a man this way at the drop of a hat, but it felt different with Lizzie, as if she were doing it for the first time. Jay did not hear the door open. Suddenly Robert was shouting in his ear,
"What the devil is this?"
The lovers broke apart.
"Calm down, Robert,"
said Jay. Robert was furious.
"Damn it! What do you think you're doing?"
he spluttered.
"It's all right, brother," said Jay. "You see, we're engaged to be married." "You swine!"
Robert roared, and he lashed out with his fist. It was a wild blow, and Jay dodged it easily, but Robert came at him with fists flailing. Jay had not fought with his brother since they were boys, but he remembered Robert being strong, though slow-moving. After ducking a rain of blows, he rushed at Robert and grappled with him. To his astonishment, Lizzie jumped on Robert's back, pummeling his head and screaming,
"Leave him alone! Leave him alone!"
The sight made Jay laugh, and he could not go on fighting. He let Robert go. Robert swung at him with a punch that hit him right beside the eye. Jay stumbled back and fell on the floor. With his unhurt eye, he saw Robert struggling to throw Lizzie off his back. Despite the pain in his face, Jay burst out laughing again. Then Lizzie's mother came into the room, followed rapidly by Alicia and Sir George. After a shocked moment, Lady Hallam said,
"Elizabeth Hallam, get off that man at once!"
Jay got to his feet, and Lizzie disentangled herself from Robert. The three parents were too bemused to speak. With one hand over his hurt eye, Jay bowed to Lizzie's mother and said,
"Lady Hallam, I have the honour to ask for your daughter's hand in marriage."
"You bloody fool, you'll have nothing to live on," Sir George said a few minutes later.